Hey everyone, thanks for listening to the Earfluence podcast. As we wind down 2021, we're going to share some of our favorite episodes from our clients that were recorded in our studio at Raleigh Founded. We'll share these episodes in December, then in January, we'll be back with new episodes of the Earfluence podcast. All right, first up, we have the Founder Connect podcast, where we interview members of the Raleigh Founded community. In this episode, Deshaun Brown, CEO of both Coworks and Lithios, talks about his journey from starting in the NC State garage to growing his companies to raising $1 million to develop his app. I was on the edge of my seat for the whole episode, so enjoy. Welcome to Founder Connect, a place where the Raleigh Founded resource providers connect with the members of the Raleigh Founded community. Today, we share another episode in our Spotlight series presented by Wyrick Robbins, where we spotlight a member of the Raleigh Founded community while digging into a specific topic relevant to founders. I'm your host, Jason Gillikin, and joining me today in the Earfluence studio at Raleigh Founded is Jess Porta, Executive Director at Raleigh Founded.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. We've got Ford Eubanks, attorney at Wyrick Robbins.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good, doing well.
Good, good. And founder and CEO of Coworks, Deshaun Brown.
Hello, glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. So today's topic is growth and fundraising. Deshaun, I am so excited to hear more from you about your fundraising for Coworks. But before we get into that, I want to hear more about your journey to get to where you are today. Just from taking a quick glance at LinkedIn, you are a Park Scholar at NC State, an Entrepreneurship Initiative Ambassador, and best I can tell, you founded a company even before graduating from NC State. So let me ask you, is entrepreneurship in your DNA?
Very good question, and all of these things are accurate. I think the answer to your question is yes, but that isn't something I discovered until sort of after the fact. Looking back, it's like, okay, yeah, maybe I was always wired this way, but yeah, that was something I had to discover during the journey. So it's kind of an interesting thing for me.
So you weren't like selling Jolly Ranchers to kids in school. you weren't going door to door selling newspapers, any of that stuff.
The closest I got to that was a neighbor and I started a lawn mowing business in middle school. And I use the word business loosely because it just meant we used his mom's printer and put it in everyone's mailbox and we charged, you know, $15 to cut people's grass or something like that. And I think we went and bought video games or something. But no, I never grew up really thinking about owning my own business or starting my own business. I was always just fascinated in learning how to make things. And I wasn't always particularly good at that either. Yeah. My sister is an artist, so she could make things with her hands and make these cool pictures. I can't color in the lines or any of that kind of thing. But I was very, very fascinated about learning how to just build something. And I spent a lot of my, I think, young adult life just trying to figure out what is it that I want to build and why. I think that was the entrepreneurship that was kind of in me, but I didn't even know how to define it until I got to NC State.
So make things. What do you mean? Like, what were you trying to make?
That's a good question. Again, that's the weird thing. Nothing in particular. I was always good at math and science. I tested really well and was always doing sort of those, you know, advanced classes. I didn't particularly like that either necessarily. I like being good at something. But, you know, I think because of that, I sort of was always kind of in these classes where we were challenging ourselves and doing these problems. So in my head, I was like, okay, well, I feel like I should go try to solve something and build something that solves a problem. Because to me, math in and of itself and science in and of itself wasn't particularly interesting, but it was just this idea of, okay, you can think critically and you can come up with some, you know, interesting solution. So I think I was trying to figure out, well, what are the problems that exist and how can I solve them? Is it through math and science? Is it through something else? And actually in high school, I fell in love with theater. So I was a big drama nerd.
Well, what was a play? Tell us a play that you were in.
Oh gosh. I was in many plays. And my director was he liked super obscure plays that no one's really heard of. Like I was in this one called The Zoo Story by Edward Albee, and it was the most crazy production ever. There was literally a 6-page monologue in it. I play basically a like deranged New York City man who's like getting, who's basically trying to break this guy on a bench who lives the same normal life and goes and eats his lunch on this bench every day. And today is the day that I'm just going to just mess with him. And anyway, it was very interesting. A more traditional play. I did musicals as well. I was in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. I was Schroeder, the piano player. That was a lot of fun. I also, for my senior project, directed musicals.
Wow.
And then directed musicals at NC State also and did some university theater there. So I think as I got older, I really started to, it went from as a kid learning, like, I want to learn how to build stuff. I want to learn how to make stuff. I thought I wanted to be at various points, like an architect or, you know, something like, very briefly, maybe a painter drawer thing until I saw my sister's stuff. I was like, cool, I didn't get that. And then I found theater. And to me, I think that I gravitated towards it because I was able to create stories and these plays and like really go into these characters. And I think found that I was interested in just that creative aspect. Mm-hmm. So when I was young, I just learned like, okay, you know, I'm doing math and doing science. I should probably build something or make something, maybe be a scientist or something. And then I sort of developed that into just like a natural creative curiosity, which then evolved into entrepreneurship.
It's so funny because I think about like when you're younger, you don't know how to tie those strings together. Right, and everybody's right. Asking, what do you want to do? I remember I had a meeting with my counselor that was like, just tell me what job you want and I'll tell you what major to get. And I was like,
right.
I don't know what job. I mean, I'm 18. You know, I don't know what job I want for the rest of my life.
Right.
But when you describe these like seemingly unrelated things, math, science, theater, somebody that doesn't know you would be like, oh, I can't put that together. As you say it, I'm like, oh my God, of course that makes sense. You've run, you know, you've used in math and science for coding to build this development business. You're creative. You turned that into a problem solving issue that brought co-works to life.
Yep.
Your theater background, you know, helped with your fundraising, your public speaking, your leadership of the team, like all of those things came into place as value. So it's kind of funny. And if there was anybody, you know, that's still in high school or college listening to this, I'd want them to take that out of that. Like, it doesn't, you don't have to put together where those little strands are like pulling you. You just follow them. And
for you know. Sure. And I had this sort of moment of truth where I was like, okay, well now I've got to decide, do I want to be a full-time actor in New York City? Or the other thing I was doing was engineering. So I think back to that sort of math science thing, like I had learned about engineering and that was sort of like this big just bubble that I put in my head. And my parents sent me to like, this is super nerdy, these like engineering camps and stuff. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll be an engineer because they make stuff. So again, I didn't know why I wasn't like, yes, I want to be a civil construction engineer. Like I was just like engineering. That's this general application of complex things to solve problems. And I had no idea what after that, but to your point, Jess, I was like, cool, I had to pick a major, I guess. So engineering. And I'm glad though, because it led me to NC State, which led to a lot of other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not that State wasn't high on my list, but they weren't. And so until I picked engineering, but yeah, I literally like, I auditioned at Juilliard in New York and was like, really had this like battle of like, well, I don't even really know what it is I truly want to do, but mm-hmm. I feel like I got to choose these things because I hadn't figured out how to connect all the dots yeah. together yet. Yeah, I picked engineering because I loved theater, but I didn't think I loved it enough to be like poor in New York City. Like you got to really love it. And I was like, yeah, I think maybe I'll pass on that. But I did truly love it. And I was able to do some university theater in NC State, which was great. I was in Little Women, if anyone's familiar with that play.
Absolutely.
I was Sir Lawrence, a.k.a. Laurie. That was a lot of fun. And then I directed musicals at Centennial Campus Middle School, which was a lot of fun as well. But yeah, it was kind of a complicated journey. And the Park Scholarship was a huge, huge thing in my life as well. That's what really, you know, put NC State over the top for obvious reasons there. Well, maybe not, but it's for people who don't know, it's a full academic scholarship to NC State. And so that was just an awesome experience. But I came in as this engineering major. I picked mechanical engineering as my focus. And literally because people told me it's the most broad. So I was like, okay, I guess that makes sense. And yeah, again, I did the math and the physics and the other stuff and it was fine, but I still hadn't figured out like, well, I don't want to build bridges. Like it's cool, I guess, but I I was still just trying to figure out, what does this even mean? But my freshman year, I took EI 201 with Jennifer Capps at NC State.
And Entrepreneurship Initiative?
Yes. Okay. It's the intro to entrepreneurship, basically.
Okay.
And I did it just, it was first semester, freshman year. And I think this is back to your question on DNA. Like, I read it. I didn't really even know what an entrepreneur was. It's one of those words where, like, you've heard it and you know, comprehend it, but I never really put too much thought into what it really means and who do I know that's an entrepreneur and what does it actually look like. And I just remember signing up for, I needed an elective and I wanted to just do something unrelated to major and something that I could just, you know, really kind of learn something I'm interested in. And I saw that class and I read the description and I was like, entrepreneurship, interesting. Like, is that, like, what is that really? So I signed up and, like, honestly, that was like the main, I think, tipping point to me, because it exposed me to this whole new world of, like, wait a minute, these entrepreneurs are, they're programmers, they're engineers, they're writers, they're actors, like, they're just people that can apply seemingly sort of unrelated, you know, mm-hmm. creative and critical thinking sort of skills to go solve problems and not be boxed into, like, manufacturing or, you know, drawing. Like, you can kind of choose how, whatever skills you have and sort of apply them. And so, and then that led me to computer science because I, of course, in today's world, when you think entrepreneurship, you have to think tech, because tech is just huge now. So that's what exposed me to coding. I never coded in my life before either. And now, you know, I run tech companies and also have a computer science degree. But again, I didn't have this like plan of action. It all sort of happened organically at State.
That's amazing. So tell me about the class, the Entrepreneurship Initiative class. And like, why was it just so appealing to you? Like, what in that class were you like, oh my gosh, this is it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And again, this is things that in real time, it wasn't really a conscious thing. It was just sort of, it's looking back on it that I'm like, oh, wow. Mm-hmm. But I think to me, one of the structures of the class was they would bring in student alumni and they would talk about their businesses. And then the first sort of project that we had was we were given these like seemingly huge global sort of issues. And we were tasked to like come up with a business to address these issues. And I hadn't really approached problem solving in that way before. It was much more like, here's a formula, solve the formula, right? What I really enjoyed was I was able to use that creative side of me, which I was clinging to with the acting and the theater, and the analytical problem solving side of me, which is like the math and the science, by taking these like huge, you know, issues and then saying, nothing's off limits. Like, what would you do? How would you solve this? How would you make a product to address this need? So yeah, I hadn't really just like thought in that way before, and I just became addicted. And then I saw people who were like, yeah, I, you know, dropped out of school and did this thing. And you should stay in school, kids, for all the people listening. I did graduate. But just like to be that passionate and like just have no fear also of like, yeah, you know, this doesn't exist, so I'm going to make it. Yeah, I think I just started to realize in my head, like, okay, wait a minute, I can create and ideate, but then I can also back that up with something practical. And also the energy, the people that I met in those classes. And that's why I became an entrepreneurship ambassador, which I also sort of did. It was like the first year they were doing it. I was like the first crop of EI ambassadors, as they called it. This is actually another big piece that would eventually lead to Coworks, some foreshadowing here, but they were launching The Garage, which is like this entrepreneurship workspace. And at the time, you know, today The Garage is awesome. And, you know, Jess and the Raleigh Founded team work with them. But back then it was this tiny, tiny little office suite. I mean, probably 300 square feet, less than that. Like, I mean, just like a little room, as big as the podcast room we're in now. And there was like a 3D printer in the corner, a whiteboard, like one little office. And it was like on the way edge of campus. The buses didn't go there. You had to like get off a bus and walk a few blocks. And we got like special key card access. And it was just this weird thing. And they kind of like used us as guinea pigs. And they're like, cool. You all are the entrepreneur ambassadors. And here's your workspace. Go be entrepreneurs and promote entrepreneurship. And I'm just a freshman. And I'm sitting here like, what does this even mean? And what are we doing here? But there was these other kids who were all I guess they knew about entrepreneurship. And so they're like, sweet, sounds good. And they were just all, they all had their own ideas and companies and they're building stuff. So I met these people who were building things and got roped into their silly schemes and just got introduced to this also style of workspace, which really the garage was a co-working space, but this is well before that term was like broadly popular. That also just like all of these things started to click to me. I was like, okay, there's this whole like world of people and workspace of just like, hey, like we go try to solve problems and build things to make people's lives better or entertain them or whatever it may be. And so, yeah, joining the garage made a big impact because I was just there every weekend working on something, learning how to build stuff. And that's where I founded my first company while in school, Lithios, which is a software development company. So we build mobile and web apps and design them for big companies and startups as well. But at the time, it was just me and a couple of friends trying to build stuff. So I got sort of through the EI and through the garage, I got introduced to software, which again, I had no prior familiarity with, but just really became sort of obsessed with this idea of like, so, okay, you can just think of something in your head, you click a few buttons on a keyboard, and then you can just like mass produce it to the world. They just download your thing. And so that coming from mechanical engineering, where you need distribution and materials and like all these things, and like one person can't just like build, you know what I mean? Like you just like, you're kind of, you're boxed into all of these, you know, resource constraints. The computer science thing to me was just like crazy. And then this was at a time when social media was really starting to blow up. Apps were starting to blow up as well. Not to, I guess, date myself too much, but yeah, like Vine was like the big thing. It was going crazy. And like, I started realizing these are all just like random people behind the scenes that built this stuff and no different than me or my friends, oftentimes the same age and then millions of dollars being acquired or, you know, millions of downloads, which the money wasn't necessarily the big motivator. It was the reach to me that I think I was really, really fascinated by. Like, what if we could do something in our dorm room that millions of people wanted like interact with? Like, why? It's just something I had in my head. So those were sort of how those blocks kind of came together. And then I switched majors to computer science, ended up graduating. But yeah, me and the Lithios crew, we would just go to the garage on a weekend and be like, cool, what are the ideas? And we'd fill up an entire whiteboard with like really stupid ideas and like vote and battle and pull hair until we could narrow it down to one. And then we would just try to build it and have no idea where to start. And we just learned how to code. Looking back, it's a wild time. And that's why, yeah, I'm not sure why I even felt like this was like feasible, but it's just like you get addicted to this entrepreneurship energy. We're like, yeah, like just try it. Just see what you can do.
Not to accelerate your story, but when you talk so much about problem solving, I can't help but think about the process of how you created CoWorks, because I feel like we were there pretty early on to sort of see that process span out. And when people always ask me like what the common factors of like, you know, companies that are successful that come through our space, because, you know, it's sort of a unproven statistic, like 9 out of 10 startups fail. People just say that. I don't know where the data for that actually is. But I do actually think it's a high failure rate, not fail in terms of like lose millions of dollars, just fail as in they tried something, it didn't work. Then those people go on, those founders go on and work for another company. We see that all the time. But we do see successful companies and they're totally different industries. They're totally different founders, personalities. And so, you know, people are like, what, ask us all the time, what do you see as commonalities, you know, among these vastly different startups that are successful? And I think the one commonality is that they found a problem and solved it. You know, I mean, it sounds really simple, but I've also heard people downstairs, you know, in our common space, I overheard this one conversation of these, a young man and woman that were, I think, out of NC State as well. They were brainstorming the next $1 million idea and they were just shooting ideas out. Like, what if we, and they were, some of them were funny and some of them were serious. I thought it was a really cute conversation, but I thought, unfortunately, none of them are going to work, because the thing that works is, you know, I find a problem, something that's driving me crazy, some problem with the DMV, and I hate this process and I've experienced it. It's hurt me. And I'm like, oh, wait, I can fix this for myself. And as soon as you find something you could fix for yourself, you could fix it for other people.
Right.
And I just think about your development of CoWorks, and you were like, I see this problem. Jess is really tired. She needs help. This is how I fold myself into this story.
It's true.
And how I'm going to take credit for everything that CoWorks has ever done.
That's right.
Jess is exhausted. She needs an assistant. Her mean boss, Jason, won't hire an assistant for her. So let's make a virtual assistant that she can afford.
Not me, different Jason. Go ahead.
Yeah. Good to clarify. The other mean Jason.
Right.
Thank you. So I think about how you've applied that, like, again, that like that strand of problem solving like comes all the way through to where you are today and how CoWorks is becoming a successful company.
Yeah, and I think you're 100% right. I think that was sort of the missing piece to me growing up, was like, I really enjoyed creating, making experiences. I enjoyed, you know, challenges, but I wanted to do something meaningful. And what I was really trying, like looking back, like I just wanted to solve a big problem.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of that entrepreneur DNA, going back to that, like I didn't know what that means, but now I know like that is the DNA, like someone who wants to be a problem solver and thinks creatively and thinks critically. And in those early days, we started off the same thing. Like, what's the $1 million idea? Some of them got some traction, but yeah, they weren't really thought through. And I think,
what's your best worst idea?
Oh God. We created a hybrid clone there was a game that was really popular called Flappy Bird. It's a little iPhone game where you just like touch the screen, mm-hmm. and a little bird just like kind of flies in the air and you just try to stay alive. And then what was then a brand new app, which was called Snapchat. And we said, what if Flappy Bird and Snapchat were the same app? And we made an app called Snappy Bird where you could send like messages to your friends like you would on Snapchat, but you had to play the game first to see the message. And like both of them are just like these. I don't know why that one in our whiteboard drawing, but somehow, you know, 2 a.m. version, no sleep version of Deshaun was like, this is it. This is the one. They were both two of the most popular apps at the time. So I guess maybe we're like, well, if we put them together, it'll be twice.
Win-win.
Exactly.
Twice
exactly.
Successful.
Exactly. It did get some popularity, but it was a very silly idea.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, that's definitely our best worst idea. But yeah, I think, you know, back to your point, Jess, like we started to learn as we were just doing stuff on our own that like we could use our newfound skills to solve other problems. People would pay us for those problems. That kind of led to our first company, which, you know, started in school, which was we were just building our own things, trying to, you know, make $1 million idea, I guess. And then people started coming to us and saying, hey, I actually have a serious idea, but I don't know how to code. You guys do, you know. I paid you, would you help us? And I was like, interesting. So people will pay us to build apps. Okay, tell me more. And yeah, that was kind of the general idea for Lithios, our first company, and was able to really build that business bootstrapped organically, no funding, literally just us started with just a sort of friend of a friend. And one of our early clients was actually a Raleigh founded member. I think they're still here, the offline folks.
Yeah.
Shout out to David Shaner. But yeah, we just learned, okay, we can use these skills and apply them and use this to kind of stay involved in the entrepreneurship and startup community. So we were doing that for a while and I was able to really learn how to grow a business. And it wasn't until we sort of stumbled on the idea for CoWorks through, you know, I think what I really like about Lithios is that customers would come to us with their problems. And they would say, here's an idea, here's a problem. And they thought they had the idea fully baked, but they never did. And we had to just learn over years how to literally jump into their brains and figure out how to execute, how we're going to design this, how we're going to build this, what's your business model. We ended up doing these things and like training these muscles, which is like what kept us energized, what kept me energized. That's what I'm really passionate about. And we were helping people, we were building things, we were creating things. And that just sort of put me in the right mindset to when we saw a problem in the world, AKA, you know, a tired Jess, that, you know, there may be an opportunity. And so, you know, the sort of story behind Co-Works is I graduated from NC State, and I, to go back to that garage story, we had got our own office for Lithios. So we're doing Lithios full time and, you know, I'm running my own business.
Which is right across the street from us right here.
That's right. Yep. That's true.
Right across the hall.
That's right. The office is right there. And so, yeah, we had to go through all of the pain points of trying to pay for an office and find an office. We did the whole sort of startup sort of grind. We rented a house together and we're working out of our garage. And then we quickly realized we needed boundaries. So, you know, we kept growing and working towards an office. I remember the day we got our first office, it was downtown Raleigh. One of my mentors, Bill Spruill, he had an extra sort of suite in his, a little extra office in his suite. And he was like, oh yeah, I'll rent it out to you guys. And we showed up and I was so proud. We had a downtown office. It was like up on the 8th floor. It was super cool. And the first day our employees showed up, they're like, where's the sink? And I was like, what? And they're like, there's no sink. So how are we going to do our dishes? I was like, what dishes? They're like, for our coffee. Also, where's the coffee maker? I was like, what? Like, we have a desk and we have Wi-Fi. Like, and we have an office. Like, my job's done. It was not done. And so, yeah, you just kind of learn, like, you got to go through, you got to set up Wi-Fi, you got to do amenities, yeah. Blah, blah, blah. So I was immediately frustrated with that. And I was like, okay, this is, and then they complained. They're like, also, it's lonely in here. Like, there's no people. I just see, you know, and I was like, we're a team. This is all you need. So that's what led me to co-working. And yeah. I like to say that when I found Raleigh Founded, it was like the garage for adults. And so.
Mostly like, adults.
Yeah, true.
I would put everybody here in that category.
That's
no offense. You know who you are.
And yeah, so I immediately fell in love because like that time at the garage, it was basically a co-working space. We had other companies, other people working on ideas. They would like walk in, see us coding and say, oh, what are you doing? Or we'd walk in and, you know, a lot of the folks that were in that kind of time with me went on to start companies, raise money and are doing really well. So we like had this kind of class of entrepreneurs at State that were in that garage and, you know, kind of went through that experience. So yeah, anyway, fell in love with co-working. Got an office here. And then, you know, I think that was like at this time where we had gone through this exercise of solving problems and creative, and I had kind of really flexed that muscle and I felt good about how to execute these things. This was also at a time where co-working was starting to become mainstream. I remember that one summer, it went from just Raleigh Founded in downtown Raleigh to I think literally 7
yep.
spaces opened up in the same summer. All downtown also, like all walking distance, like yeah. from each other. And I was just like, wow, like something is happening, and really just became obsessed, started researching. This is at a time when, you know, the WeWorks of the world were coming out of New York and starting to globally expand. And yeah, I became obsessed, started really digging deeper into how these spaces operate and run. You know, quickly realized that I could never get time with any of the community managers, Jess included, because they were just doing so much. And I was just like, why are they always so busy? Like, I don't understand. Because I had all these ideas and questions. And we'd call people and they're like, I don't have 5 minutes. And I'm like, 5 minutes? Like, how, what? And it's just because co-working is just a super interesting hybrid of like hospitality and workspace and event space and retail space. And it's like a whole different approach to workspace. And so we quickly found that. So my first sort of inclination was, how does this even work? Like, how can you do so many things at one time? And then we were also kind of coming from it from the member experience. Like, we were here. So we also knew how some of the operations worked. Not all great. And so yeah, it really, that's kind of how we landed on Co-Works.
And you interviewed how many spaces? It was a lot.
Oh yeah.
In your market research.
Yeah. And again, this is why I think going through my time at Lithios was so important, because we learn how to validate ideas before you just
A lot of people skip market research.
Yeah.
Loads of companies skip market research. And right. I think, again, when you look at these successful companies, I said solving a problem, but the other one is they validated their ideas and they pivoted when it wasn't exact, instead of just bullishly driving forward with the one thing they thought was going to stick.
100%.
And you guys interviewed loads.
Hundreds. I mean, hundreds. Yeah. I think we literally talked to 100 different spaces.
Why did you think like this was our $1 million idea? I just want to make sure.
Sort of, you know, I think for me, I've always been a product person. Like once we started really doing this, like I knew, like, even though with Lithios, I liked helping other people and helping them build their products and solve their problems, I still never got away from the desire to, you know, that whiteboard, like putting our own ideas and you know, figuring out which one would actually succeed. And I felt like I had learned so much that we weren't just throwing darts at a whiteboard anymore. I actually knew how to like find which ones were solving actual problems and validate. So when I had this initial idea, I tried to just forget about it. And it was just one of those things that kept coming and kept coming. And I just find myself up late at night researching co-working, and no one knew what it was at the time either. So like I couldn't even really speak to people about it, but we had a good business going. And this sort of kind of transitions into fundraising and how do you scale a business and those kind of things. And a product and a services business are two totally different things. Like with Lithios, we grew organically. We were able to, each customer we had paid us for the engagement. And so we were able to sort of grow in that capacity. But with a product, you don't just start out with millions of customers paying you. You start out with nothing. And so I knew if I was going to spend time and resources on this, it should probably be worth it. And also, to be completely honest, the rest of my team hated the idea. So that's kind of the other thing. And I'm kind of glad that happened that way.
Yeah.
Because I could have easily just been like, here's my idea. And everyone's like, great, Deshaun, you're a genius. Did not happen that way.
But you had to prove it out.
Yeah.
And to us too, I was thinking about that first meeting. I'm not even sure we ever talked about this, Deshaun. But we were using a different, it's interesting how we started. So we were starting out using Salesforce. There weren't really tools when Raleigh Founders started, period. And you all are familiar with Salesforce. There's a payment system in there and there's sort of a directory, but it's really designed it's a point of sale, you know?
Sure.
So we were sort of using that. And then we were using another software to book rooms. We were using Excel spreadsheets to keep track of events.
Yep.
And we were using QuickBooks to bill people. And so we had 5 or 6 different softwares.
Yep.
And then I was hired on, you know, a couple of years later. And then I started researching ERP systems because I felt like we were more of a operational company. And I stumbled upon Nexidus, which does sort of co-working management, or they did at the time. I'm not even sure they're still doing it.
Right.
So it was like sort of what we were doing, but more geared towards co-working and had a few other capabilities.
Right.
It was the only thing that existed at the time.
Yep.
So I spent months implementing that. I mean, months. It was such a complex software. I was happy with it because we could do anything, but it was so complex. I was the only person on our team that understood it. I made 100-page, you probably remember, getting this, PowerPoint, 100-slide PowerPoint to teach other team members how to use it and document it. And then I became like a bottleneck, but I didn't see that as a problem. I just got us into this new age.
Right.
And then Deshaun writes me and wants to pitch a new idea for how to manage that software. It was Lakeisha or somebody else that told me that you guys wanted to meet. And I was like, you know, however this meeting goes, we're not going to switch. I just did this. So I go into this meeting like, I've said no to a lot of people because people come in, they want to sell us new softwares to manage this and new, you know, custom rugs and whatever the thing is, right? And so I was just like, I just need to balance how softly, gently I let them down was my actual mentality. And that's so hilarious. I went in very, you know, very guarded, and I didn't know Deshaun well. And, you know, we got into this meeting and I think we were 5 minutes in and I was like, God damn it. We're going to have to switch software.
I'll have to trash that PowerPoint. Oh, well.
I remember.
I was so defeated and yet like, so relieved.
And I remember, Jess, you said, if I ever got hit by a bus, we'd be in so much trouble because I'm the only one that knows how to use this. And I think, I'm kind of glad these things happened because it helped me not skip steps, especially if you're an entrepreneur and you can code and you've like built apps for other people before. you start to just be like, oh, I know how this works. I'm just going to skip steps, build it, deploy it. It'll be fine. And I think took these natural pushbacks that I was getting and was like, okay, well, we should make sure that we actually do this the right way. And hence the market research. And yeah, I mean, I think what I found at the time was that not only was there an opportunity because most people were using 6 or 7 different systems to manage these spaces, which means the members had to use 6 or 7 different systems as well.
Yep,
one thing for your staff, but for your members, they don't understand why they have to do that. And they don't want to log in 5 or 6 different times. They just want to do one thing. And then also knowing that, you know, we were going to have to convince people to change their whole operations. We had to come in with something meaningful. And I think that's where I was able to focus on some of the like user experience and the design and like, why are we better? What are we doing different? And I guess for, you know, those that don't know that sort of with Coworks, what we do today is we are a full service co-working and flexible workspace management system. And this is all pre-COVID. So this is also before, and this is when, in the early days of co-working also, and I'll talk about how I think the world's changed now and why that's actually interesting for us and how I think we're poised to be able to help facilitate people into the new way of work. Yeah. But we handle all of this sort of operational components of managing a co-working and flex space. So billing, room booking, managing your offices, managing your members, managing your teams, managing your events, managing your resources. And then we also provide that member experience as well, where the people who work in the space get one thing that they log into that has the capability to let them book rooms and see their invoices and also connect with other people. And I think I just looked at that. That's why I think that time back in the garage was so important for me, because I was in co-working, I'd had this other experience, and I just had a different perspective on why co-working was even important and why the system that we use to help these people manage needed to embody what the ethos of co-working really was, which is community building and hospitality and service, and more than just like a back office, you know, data management type tool. Now, we had to have all those things and we had to do those things well too. And so that's the challenge of, let's do everything everyone else has, but then let's do it better and add these other higher level experiences. And to me, it's like, that was a challenge. And I got a lot of no's, including during the fundraising process.
let's hold off on the fundraising for a second. So I've used the app. It's awesome. And congratulations on putting that together. But let's bring you into the conversation here. And you've been super patient.
Sure. Happy to. I'm happy to hear Deshaun's story.
I mean, great story, right?
Right.
But I want to go back to where Deshaun was at with Lithios and potentially spinning off another company from Lithios. Right. So as an attorney, like, what do companies need to look at there when he's in a situation where the co-founders are like, I don't know about this, but is it something where the company's spinning off to another company? Is it just him? What are all the things that Deshaun needs to think about in that process?
That's a good question. I mean, so especially when you already have a successful company up and going and it's clear, I mean, it was a service business. It was going well. One piece of business was leading to the next. It had nice organic growth. And you're looking at the alternative, which is, let's go take a big risk. Let's create a product. Let's take resources away from a successful venture and put it into the unknown. And so kind of that is, there's a risk, and everybody on the team kind of has to, that's why they were skeptical. You know, they were all had to look at each other and go, are we going to take our time away from what's doing well and try to do something else, maybe better or different? And so I think from a business perspective and a team perspective, the first thing is to make sure everyone's happy with going that direction, or at least enough people are enough happy taking part of their time or all of their time and saying, hey, let's keep Lithios going, but let's go start this other thing and see if we can get that going. But you have to have a vision of the future and saying, when we're done, are we going to have enough people on both teams or able to split up our efforts meaningfully so that we still check all the boxes to keep both companies growing? And that might mean finding a new person to add to one or both teams or new people. That might mean establishing roles and having that discussion on a set timeline. Like, we're going to come back together every month and we're going to discuss whether or not we're meeting the needs of both companies, whether we're growing both companies and getting funding and doing, you know, and we'll shift our roles as we need. We'll look for people to add to this team as we need. And so that's the business side of it. But from a legal perspective, it is important if you decide you are going to start a new venture that is separate from the existing one and you want to separate potential legal liability, yep. You're going to start down a new path and you want to make sure new customers, you know, aren't going to be mad at the old company and be like, well, you guys are one and the same. I'm going to be mad at both of you, you know? So it's good to draw the line in the sand to go start a new company, to establish roles and make sure that people that are full-time at one, full-time employees at one or not employees at the other, or create part-time relationships, consulting relationships so that both companies are formally set up apart from each other.
Yeah.
So that's a really important aspect. And then also you get your lawyer to think about all those little details, but at the same time, also make sure that everyone's incentivized in both companies, right? And that incentive lines up to what they are working towards at both companies. So in the service company, maybe someone is adding daily value, you know, so maybe they get a compensation in line with that, a salary or whatever. But the other one, you know, they're putting time in for an amount unknown, a success unknown. Maybe they're getting a piece of equity, or maybe they're getting incentive equity over time that vests to show the amount of contribution they've made. And so I've found one of the key success factors in either splitting off a new business or just starting a new business is to align everybody's incentives around the table, both consistent so that they're happy and that they're contributing to the team, but that also it accurately represents what they're bringing to the team. And especially, you know, you want to talk about funding later, when you're getting to the funding table, showing that you guys as a founding group have talked about that and are comfortable with what you're all bringing to the table, that it's a full picture of the solution that's needed for the problem you've identified, and that your incentives are reasonably lined up to that. And so you're not just going to be excited about it today, you're going to be excited about it 2 years from now.
Port, I was wondering, you know, you've both sort of danced around this idea of talking about bootstrapping versus fundraising. If one of you could just take a stab at defining the difference between those two, in case somebody doesn't know that already that's listening in. And I'm just curious, from a legal perspective and a business perspective, what are the liabilities? What are the pros and cons of each? Because it's not super cut and dry for people just in service industry versus a product industry. It could be either.
You want to take on bootstrapping since you managed to pull that off?
I will. And let me also just say, Ford, you nailed it with the, you know, answer on, you know, the two different companies. And I wish I'd asked you a few years ago, and I probably would have saved several years, because you nailed it down into 2 minutes and I had to trial and error for 3 years. So
I'm on the phone a lot.
So definitely, yes, that's I co-sign this.
That should also be a plug for why Rick Robbins has office hours, and they will consult with Raleigh founded members for free.
It's all right. Stop by.
That's right. I will do that now. but yeah, so real quick on bootstrapping. It's brutal, but yeah, I mean, I think for us, the way that you grow your business totally depends on the type of business. And that's, I think, the biggest lesson I've learned through this whole journey is that there is no one size fit all. I kind of came in saying, well, I'm just going to do what I feel like doing, and I don't feel like raising money, or let's do it. I want to own it all, whatever. And so, yeah, that's cute. But like, I do think it's all about your goals. Like, do you want to grow quickly? Do you need to grow quickly? Why do you need to grow quickly? Is there competition? Is there a, you know, cultural timing thing? Like, what is the real reason? And from the organic side, you know, looking at that, well, what is the realistic growth trajectory based on our target market or customer base, where they're located, our price points? So for us, with the bootstrapping model, and I think services is a lot easier to do that with. It's not easy. No business is easy to start or finish or scale or anything. But I do think what's nice is that, yeah, every time we could, you know, just grind, go out, network, do whatever we need to do. And then we land one client, and the dollar value of those clients was pretty significant. It's not cheap to build apps, I'm afraid to say. You know, it can cost anywhere from, you know, a few thousand to $100,000+. And it all depends on what it is you're trying to build. You know, all the big apps we use today have teams, and they've spent millions of dollars on one little app. And so, you know, I think for us, we had this good sort of ratio where the time and effort it took us to land a deal was sort of offset by the size of the deal that we were able to then land. Mm-hmm. And then it paid for us to go do it again. And during that time, we would get a little bit better and a little bit faster and a little bit more articulate. And then our portfolio would expand, and that allowed us to just get more credibility, because the first time no one wants to be the first group to get an app by us. And they're like, oh no, like, how do we know you know what you're doing? Yeah. Now, you know, we build apps for Fortune 500 companies. We've got big, huge logos, and like, they can go talk to those people and get real validation that we did it and it did it well. So the sales just get easier. So yeah, I think with bootstrapping, you just got to understand, how much are you charging for your service or product? How many people can you get in front of, and kind of do that math on like, and then how much money do you want to make? Are you willing to, you know, what kind of lifestyle do you want? And then what resources do you have at your disposal? And I think for us, I also knew that I could code, so I didn't have to pay for a programmer, which is very expensive also. Yeah. So the tasks that we needed and the help that we needed, the economics kind of made sense for us to grow organically.
You put in your own time. A lot of people also have to put in their own money up front, and you're totally on the line risk-wise. Is that right?
Absolutely. And that's exactly right. With a business like Deshaun with Lithios, you know, he was able to invest his time, the money to the extent he needed to live and to build his team. And he was able to bring business in and organically take the money from that new business and support the growth of the business. And so, you know, the idea of grabbing, you know, lifting your own self up by your bootstraps is where that term comes from.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's basically what you did. And it's incredibly impressive. And it doesn't, to your point, it works well in service industries sometimes, but often if you're trying to develop a prototype or do a proof of concept or reach a market that you have to be a certain size, like Coworks, to even get in front of them to go, I've developed a full solution, requires an outlay of money that a group of founders doesn't normally have. And honestly, nor should they come up with. I mean, even investors understand that they don't want their founders financially stressed. They want them focused on providing a solution, and there's access to capital for the right team and the right ideas. So it's honestly proving a concept enough to get it in front of investors and getting investor buy-in is a great milestone for a company to prove it to the founders around the table. Hey, we just raised $1 million. You know, people like our idea. Let's go spend some nights and weekends. You know, let's go put all of our effort into this. Let's make it successful, both for us and for our investors who've put their beliefs in us. So that to me is a lot of fun as well. And obviously Deshaun's enjoying that ride right now, getting to go raise external capital, getting to meet the investor community, explain your idea. And that's why, you know, your 100 interviews with co-working spaces, there isn't a question that investors ask as far as your business and the solution you're providing that you're really incapable of answering, at least enough to make them happy. You know what I mean? Like that your business better than anybody else in the room. And that is how you get through the first gate with investors, right? Because a lot of these smart institutional investors, they do their homework. If they're looking at a company, they're gonna become a two-day expert on any company they're in an industry they're gonna invest in. They're gonna come ask you as many hard questions as they can to try and figure out whether you've been working on this longer than 2 days, right? And that's really the first part. And then the second part, you know, apart from the idea and addressing a good need, is the team you've got around the table. And so they're gonna talk to everybody around the table, make sure that people are sharp and understand their area of responsibility. They're committed to the long-term growth of the company, that they have been incentivized properly, that, you know, and then they get their lawyers to come in and kick the tires and read all the documents and make sure that the I's are dotted and T's crossed. But it's really about identifying the right team and making sure that everyone, you know, the founding team is committed to the company and, you know, proceeding into success over the next time period. So
definitely,
you know, one thing you mentioned, you know, you just went through a fundraising stage, Deshaun. I'll let you talk more about that. But it's important that companies, when they're seeking financing, to identify what they're going to get out of that round of financing. And when you go to investor to go, you know, I'm raising X amount of money. I'm where I am now, and our team is where they are now. With X amount of money, we'll be able to do this. And this, whatever this is, whether it's build a prototype or get to a market or proof a concept, will get us to the point where we can get to the next stage. And that is either raising more money or IPO or selling us or organic growth. I mean, it might be, you know, we'd hope this is the last money we ever have to raise. Wouldn't that be great for the investors? You know, but maybe it's we need only X amount of money to show what we can do. And then we're going to go get even more, you know, because that's how we take over the world with this new idea. So
I know there's people probably that will listen to this and be like, oh my God, I wish somebody would have told me that before. Because I can't tell you how many people go and just ask for money and share their idea, but don't say what they're going to use the money for.
Right. 100%. And, you know, I had to also kind of learn all these things the hard way. So, you know, I felt like, okay, cool. I've proven I can start a business. I've proven I know how to build software. You know, I have a lot of people who can speak to that. I'm not even a first-time founder, technically. And so after sort of validating these ideas, we started working on the prototype for Coworks. And back to sort of a funny thing that maybe you didn't know, Jess, in the meeting that we had where you intended to let us down softly, the stakes were pretty high because I told my team right before that meeting, if we don't sign these people, we're not doing it.
Whoa.
And I said,
I love this, Sushant. It's amazing. I said,
we're going to do it. And if we can't sign them, we don't deserve to do this company. And I laid those table stakes before the meeting. God. Which I'm not sure whether I drank too much coffee that day or what inspired me to do that, but they were all like, okay.
So, we could do a play about this, this like kind of sort of Machiavelli.
Yeah. Like, so the they were high stakes there that you didn't even know. It worked out. But yeah, So I knew that, like, and so we had customers also. So I used my experience to build a product. I validated it. We even had some customers. So to me, my work was done. You should, you know, I was like, great. Investors will just give us money. Right. but no, you're right, Jess. Like, I had to sort of change my mindset of understanding So first, there is access to capital. And that was something that I did learn and saw. And I was like, great. But yeah, I had to learn how to pitch. I had to learn how to speak the language that investors wanted to hear. And at first, it's easy to kind of get confused or take things personally. But then you realize these are people who are doing their diligence. They are literally trying to become two-day experts in your business. They're going to ask you tough questions and they want to make sure you've thought about it. Even if I already kind of knew how big it could be and that it worked and all these other things, I still had to learn how to like showcase our, like forecast our future and forecast how we're going to grow and what we're going to do with the money and why. And, you know, those were things that I hadn't really thought through all the way when we first started fundraising. And I think for us, one thing that really helped was we ended up applying and getting into Techstars. And so Techstars is one of the most kind of prestigious global accelerator companies in the world, in the country. Basically, they take technology companies, a certain number apply per year. They only take a small few, I think less than 2%. And they will invest in you a very small amount, but there is some money. And then you go through their program and they give you access to all these mentors and you're working with these other teams. So again, back in this like, you know, garage type experience again with these other companies. But that's how I sort of learned that side of the equation, because I had this product knowledge and I know how to build engaging experience and how to talk to customers and that kind of thing. But there's also financial forecasting and other things that I'm a little less interested in, or at least was back then. And I think that was a great opportunity for us because Techstars is good at identifying founders who are sort of early on, but are onto something that could be pretty big, and then giving them that translation on this is how you need to present it so that the investors get it. And I mean, it made a big difference, right? Like, it wasn't that we changed. Well, we did change our approach and we pivoted a little bit, but mostly we changed how we presented ourselves and our vision and articulated it. So that made a huge difference for us being able to then come back to investors after taking this, you know, accelerator, 3 months in Techstars, and that's validation in and of itself. We grew more, we developed the product more. And it all culminated in this big demo day, which brought me, you know, full circle back to the theater days, because you're on stage, there's like 1500 people there, they're recording it. And I just remember all the other founders were so, they were concerned more about the sort of theatrics of it. And that was like my least concern. I was more concerned about the pitch deck and the content. And, you know, it was kind of the opposite for them. They sort of, you know, lived and breathed in their pitch decks, but they'd never been on stage before. And so, but I think that gave me an advantage too. Like, mm-hmm. I understood how to work a crowd, how to project, how to sort of, you know, and I think it helps me in meetings too. It just makes you a better presenter in general. So it is kind of cool to see all those little things sort of come full circle, kind of in my own journey. But yeah, so came out of Techstars, and that's how we sort of learned those things that I, you know, didn't know when it comes to fundraising on, you know, what are investors really looking for?
We are going to pause right there on part one of the interview with Deshaun Brown from Coworks and Lithios and come back next week where we'll talk about what companies need to do to be ready to take investment. It's not a simple process, but Deshaun has gone through it and Ford has guided companies through it as well. Until then, thank you for listening to this special series of the Founder Connect podcast brought to you by Wyrick Robbins. If you like the show, be sure to follow along on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. To find Deshaun's companies, visit lithiosapps.com and coworksapp.com. For Wyrick Robbins, visit wyrick.com, that's W-Y-R-I-C-K, or find Ford Eubanks on LinkedIn. For Raleigh Founded, where we recorded this podcast, visit raleighfounded.com. And finally, for full-service podcast production, visit earfluence.com. I'm Jason Gilligan, and we'll see you soon on Founded Connect.